This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
And welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Esther Githu-Ewart, in for Yahez Wuhib, right here in Washington.
The partnership represents an important step towards preventing the kinds of gross inequities of access to life-saving vaccines that emerged during the COVID pandemic.
This is Africa News Tonight. Richard Hatchett, Chief Executive Officer for the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, on a deal to make four vaccines used in Africa. Also, Africa's largest e-commerce company launched the first commercial drone delivery service on the continent this week. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. The Serum Institute of India signed a deal this week with South Africa's Aspen Pharmacare to make four vaccines used in Africa. The deal has been hailed as saving local vaccine production, which was at risk of closing after receiving no orders for a COVID vaccine. But medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says more efforts are needed for vaccines to be fully produced in Africa for Africans. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
The four routine pediatric vaccines will be made in South Africa with products from bulk drug substance supplied by India's Serum Institute. They are the pneumococcal, rotavirus, polyvalent meningococcal, and hexavalent vaccines. In addition to the 10-year agreement, South Africa's Aspen Pharmacare also anticipates receiving grant funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, CEPI. Here's CEPI's Chief Executive Officer, Richard Hatchett.
The partnership represents an important step towards preventing the kinds of gross inequities of access to life-saving vaccines that emerged during the COVID pandemic. We are proud to be part of an effort that will secure critically needed vaccine manufacturing capacity in Africa for Africa, so that it can be ready when it faces future epidemic or pandemic threats.
But Candice Sahoma with Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign in South Africa is calling for more than just fill and finish deals.
I think it's a great step towards realizing the African continent's manufacturing capacity, particularly looking at vaccines, and actually looking into routine vaccines. I think that for me is a great step, but I think definitely we could do with a lot more and even a full sharing of technology so we don't find ourselves waiting in line for vaccines that are coming from high-income countries.
Pietro Terblanche, the managing director of the South African company Afrigen, which produced Moderna's mRNA COVID vaccine, says Aspen's deal with the Serum Institute may not be healthy for other companies on the continent, as it could drown out local competition.
The manufacturing capacity and the technology capabilities and the reach of the Serum Institute is very dominant. It is very, very powerful. However, if the Serum Institute is prepared to do partnerships with Africa and South Africa for end-to-end manufacturing and technology transfer to Africa, it's a positive development.
Meanwhile, Dr. Ahmed Ogwell Omar, Deputy Director of the Africa Centres for Disease Control and Prevention, says the agreement is an important step for African vaccine manufacturing.
It has responded to Africa Union heads of state and government call that 30% of our continent's requirements for human vaccines be procured from African manufacturers. And we look forward to this being motivation for more and expanded manufacturing of vaccines here on the continent of Africa.
According to the Africa CDC, less than 1% of vaccines currently used on the continent are locally manufactured. Aspen's group communications consultant, Shernine Bukas, says they cannot comment on calls for the full African production of vaccines at this stage. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Hi. Africa's largest e-commerce company, Jumia, launched the first commercial drone delivery service on the continent this week, offering delivery of products across Ghana. Jumia is working with a California-based company, Zipline, to make the deliveries. If successful, the companies plan to expand the service to other parts of West Africa. Victoria Munga reports for VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
After more than 3 months of testing in the town of Omenaku, e-commerce firm Jumia and U.S. instant delivery service Zipline have started drone delivery of products to homes in Ghana. The service is available nationwide in the West African country. Jumia says it has made 100 delivery flights so far. Apovra Kumar is Jumia's chief operations officer.
Today, we believe it's a great enabler to service far-flung areas in Africa very quickly, in good speed, and also with great amount of sustainability and safety.
A March 2022 Forbes report shows that Africa still lags in access to energy and road networks, but the continent has made significant strides in the internet penetration, which is estimated at 70%. So digital entrepreneurs are using technology to solve problems that are typically reserved for more traditional forms of infrastructure. Economists like Ken Gichinga say that poor addressing systems for homes are still a major obstacle to drone delivery.
Droning, if it's mapped well with geomapping, can really open up the industry in terms of delivery. But for good delivery, we need to have proper addressing system. We don't have, like in the West, a proper addressing system.
According to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, Africa is also lagging behind in key aspects of e-trade because of connectivity issues, lack of payment systems, and various government policies. Less than 40% of African countries have adopted data privacy legislation. Economist Wahoro Ndoho tells VOA, if consumers fear their personal information will be shared with the wrong party, he says the drones for delivery business may not take off.
Africa is ready for drones to the extent that, in one sense, it leapfrogs the whole question of building an infrastructure. For example, like what they've done in Rwanda and other parts of Africa, where they've used drones for delivery of medicine. But there must be an underlying system, ecosystem, that supports the seeking advantage of drones.
Jumia currently operates in 11 African countries with more than 30 warehouses. The group hopes to expand drone delivery services across the continent in the future. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
President Joe Biden will host South African President Cyril Ramaphosa at the White House on September 16th as the administration looks to draw African nations closer to the U.S. The announcement comes as South Africa and many of other nations on the continent have taken a neutral position on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. administration has been disappointed that South Africa and other nations have not followed many Western countries in condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine. News agencies report the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has nominated Abdoulaye Bathily to be the new United Nations envoy to Libya. France's UN ambassador said Thursday he thinks the Security Council will approve the former Senegalese official and UN diplomat, which would end a nine-month search. The last UN special representative, Jean Kubis, resigned last November after 10 months. France's ambassador said he doesn't think opposition to Bathily from Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah, who led Libya's transitional government, will be a problem in trying to end Libya's political crisis. In Ethiopia's Gambela region, a June attack on the capital by the rebel group, the Oromo Liberation Army, has raised fears of a civil war spreading in the country. Reporter Henry Wilkins spoke to local officials and analysts about what's behind the violence and what it could mean for Ethiopia's security.
In Gambela City, security has been beefed up. Officials say local police have started working in cooperation with troops recently sent to the region by the federal government. A major attack by two rebels, the Oromo Liberation Army, OLA, and the Gambela Liberation Front, GLF, caught the city by surprise in June. Local media said up to 37 people were killed. Analysts say it is the first time the Oromo conflict, a decades-old fight among local, federal forces and ethnic Oromo rebels, has reached Gambela City. One witness recounts seeing the OLA enter the city. Abdu Abubekar is a civil servant.
He
says the shooting began at around 6 a.m. No one was expecting it, so no one was well prepared, Abdu Abubakar says. The OLA and the GLF entered the city as far as the regional council building, he says. They entered the city from three directions. I think the Gambela Liberation Front was leading the OLA. Less than a week later, in the Oromia region, around 400 ethnic Amhara were killed by OLA militants. The rapid uptick in violence in what Human Rights Watch calls Ethiopia's other conflict has led some to question if it constitutes a second civil war for the country. Information from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project shows that from August 2021 to July 2022, there were 3,784 deaths linked to the OLA, compared with 651 the previous year, a nearly fivefold increase. William Davidson, an analyst with International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based research organisation, says the increased violence is the result of long-standing grievances related to Oromo self-determination and lack of political representation in Ethiopia's federal system, especially since the current government came to power in 2018.
I think that added fuel to the Oromo Liberation Army insurgency. So after the failure to reintegrate those fighters, their rebellion.
The Oromo comprise the largest ethnic group in the country. Davison was asked if the conflict is as significant as Ethiopia's headline-grabbing war with Tigrayan rebels in the north of the country.
Probably doesn't immediately threaten the regional government authority in Adamawa or the federal government authority in Addis Ababa, but it is, you know, affecting a huge number of people in Oromia, as well as leading to direct violence that's killing combatants and civilians.
Adama is a city in the Oromia region. For now, Gambela is calm, but fewer than 10 kilometres beyond its outskirts, local police say there are regular firefights with the OLA. Local officials are keen to project stability. Chankot Chote is head of the Gambela Regional State Peace and Security Office. He says with the help of the special forces, federal police and regular police and the community, the situation has improved. He adds that although the OLA is trying to attack on the outskirts of town, they will never enter the city again. The OLA is an offshoot of another rebel group, the Oromo Liberation Front, which signed a peace deal with the Ethiopian government in 2018. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Gambela, Ethiopia.
Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga, who contested his loss in last month's presidential election in the Supreme Court, said he will respect the court's ruling but still believes he won. The court has until September 5th to announce its ruling. Experts are expecting some scenarios for the Supreme Court's ruling. And Paul Nantulia, research associate at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed these scenarios and what a stable Kenya means for the rest of the region with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
A stable and functional Kenya means a great deal for the region. I think it's important to note there are a number of key lessons that Kenya's neighbors can learn coming out of this election. The first is that it was a genuinely competitive election. Yeah. Right up to the 11th hour, nobody knew who the winner would be. This is a stark contrast to what we see among Kenya's neighbors, where elections are really just foregone conclusions and are really just formal exercises whereby the winner is known beforehand. So Kenya is very different in that regard. The second is Kenya's electoral environment was very, very different. So if you look at the changes that were made to Kenya's election laws, for instance, making the IEBC independent, permitting the non-governmental sector and NGOs and individuals to access the IEBC portal, this is something that is absolutely unheard of in East, Southern and Central Africa. Absolutely unheard of. And it was a first in Kenya and very much a first in Africa, where anybody could access the IEBC data and do tallying on their own. Indeed, 72 hours before the IEBC started announcing its results, the media was already releasing provisional results from the IEBC. So this is a second major lesson, and it will be absolutely critical. Kenya is setting an example for democracy and democratization in the region. The third is the active involvement and vigilance of civil society. A civil society was very engaged. In fact, we owe civil society a debt of gratitude for this electoral environment. The petitions that they put forth several years ago before the high courts, which were upheld by the Supreme Courts, have been able to get Kenya to be able to have an election in the kind of environment that it had. I'll just mention the Maina Kiai petition, one of the successful petitions, whereby the high court agreed with the petition and ordered that the final results that are recorded at each polling station cannot be altered in any way, even by the IEBC chair. And what we saw in previous elections is that the IEBC chair was vested with a lot of power to interpret results coming from the polling stations, to even alter results. This was overturned thanks to the petition that people like Maina Kiai and figures within civil society have been able to push through the courts. So I think strategic litigation by civil society is another critical example, I believe, that Kenya has set for its neighbors.
So what kind of scenarios you expect for Kenya?
Well, there are three scenarios. The first scenario is the Supreme Court upholds William Ruto's victory. But even in that scenario, the Supreme Court could still identify problematic issues in the process of the elections, criticize those issues, and order new and more robust laws to basically reinforce the laws that have already been put in place through the strategic litigation activities that I mentioned earlier. The second scenario is the election could be annulled like it was in 2017 on the basis that critical aspects of the constitution were not respected, and in which case Kenya would have 60 days to hold another election. The third scenario, the Supreme Court could basically make a ruling that due to the irregularities that would have been identified in certain areas, the Supreme Court could order elections in particular areas, not the whole country, but in particular areas as a result of irregularities that just took place. So these would be the three scenarios. But irrespective of the scenarios that emerge, it would be extremely important. And as we've seen, I think it's very commendable that Kenyans, aggrieved parties, have decided to go to the courts, have decided to use constitutional methods. And I think that will be important. The second thing that would be important would be bringing the country together, because it's clearly this election has shown that the country is deeply divided. The country is deeply divided politically, and it would be important for all the members of the political class in Kenya to bring the country together so as to stabilize the country, normalize it, and begin moving it forward. So I think these would be the two critical issues, regardless of which way the Supreme Court rules.
The first U.S. ambassador to Sudan in 25 years has vowed to support the country's transition to civilian rule. John Godfrey spoke while presenting his credentials yesterday to Sudan's military-led government. Michael Atit reports from capital Khartoum.
Ambassador John Godfrey presented his credential documents as the new U.S. ambassador to Sudan on Thursday in a ceremony at Sudan's presidential palace. The document was presented to Sudan's military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who led the coup against the civilian government in October last year. Al-Burhan, the chairman of Sudan's Transitional Sovereignty Council, welcomed the return of a U.S. ambassador to Sudan after a 25-year absence. He stressed the importance of developing relations between Khartoum and Washington and said he hoped Godfrey's appointment represent a new impetus for the two countries' relationship. Speaking to reporters in Arabic after the diplomatic ceremony, Ambassador Godfrey expressed the commitment of his country to build new relations with Sudan. Godfrey said, "I'm so happy to be the new ambassador of the United States in Sudan after more than 25 years. He said, "I'm happy to have this opportunity to work in Sudan and get to understand people and their cultures more closely." Godfrey was named by the White House as the new ambassador to Sudan in early January. The U.S. Congress approved his appointment in July, and he arrived in Khartoum last week to assume his post. Ties between the United States and Sudan were severely strained under the three-decade rule of ousted President Omar al-Bashir, with Washington slapping crippling economic sanctions on Khartoum. The U.S. government blacklisted Sudan in 1993 as a state sponsor of terrorism because the Bashir administration hosted al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden, who resided in the country between 1992 to 1996. The ambassador's arrival comes as Sudan reels from deepening unrest and sinking economy. Godfrey says the U.S. government hopes to see an inclusive civilian-led government restored in Sudan to complete the remaining transitional period. He said, we expect to see the establishment of a new government led by civilians in Sudan within a comprehensive dialogue that supports all Sudanese political parties, including the democratic supporting forces. Godfrey previously worked as the acting special envoy to the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. He also formerly worked as the acting deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Authorities in Sudan's Blue Nile state have declared a curfew in Ghanaian and Arusheri's towns after fresh intercommunal clashes left at least 9 people dead and injured more than 20 others. VOA's South Sudan in Focus says there are reports of people fleeing to Al-Damazin town today. The Blue Nile Civil Society Network condemned the killings and has called for calm in the area. In July, intercommunal clashes erupted between the Hausa and Bereti tribes in Blue Nile, killing nearly 100 people and injuring about 200 others. Government authorities deployed security forces to restore calm.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With its rapidly growing populations, great free trade areas, diverse ecosystems, and one of the largest regional voting groups in the United Nations, sub-Saharan Africa will undoubtedly play a significant role in resolving global problems, such as tackling the climate crisis, as well as in shaping the rules of the world on vital issues like trade, cyber, and emerging technologies. However, before it can fully ascend to its leadership position on the global stage, sub-Saharan Africa must overcome several obstacles that are stymieing its progress. The most pressing of these are ending the COVID-19 pandemic and tackling food insecurity and malnutrition. The United States is ready to work with partners in sub-Saharan Africa to recover from the devastation wrought by COVID-19 and lay the foundation for broad-based, sustainable economic opportunity to improve the lives of our people, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We know the pandemic has dealt a devastating blow to Africa. Lives lost, livelihoods shattered. More than 55 million Africans have been driven into poverty by the pandemic, setting back decades of hard-earned progress.
We provided more than 170 million doses of safe, effective COVID vaccines to African countries, free of charge and with more to come, said Secretary Blinken. Also, since the beginning of the year, the United States has sent more than $6.6 billion in humanitarian and food assistance to Africa. Still, our African colleagues made clear that beyond emergency relief, what they really want is more investment in agricultural resilience, innovation, self-sufficiency. We're responding to those calls.
Feed the Future will invest $11 billion over 5 years in 20 partner countries, 16 of which are in Africa. And a new initiative we launched with the United Arab Emirates is turbocharging investment in innovation in climate-smart agriculture. It's not just agriculture. Across a range of fields, the United States is working with African partners to try to unlock innovation and growth. As we do, we're building on African-led initiatives, such as the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, which, when fully implemented, will comprise the fifth largest economic bloc in the world, and also the African Union's Agenda 2063.
We believe in the nations of Africa, in the continent-wide spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation, said President Biden. And through the challenges ahead, although they are great, there is no doubt that our nations, our people, the African Union, we're up to this task.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. For Yahez Wahib, I'm Esther Githu-Ewart in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaru, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local